This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, listeners from around the world in 164 countries worldwide. This is your host, Jason Hartman. Thank you so much for joining me today as we dive in to a 10th episode show. Yes, any show, any episode that ends in a zero is where we talk about something of general interest, something that will help us be more successful in life and just live a better, more fulfilling, more powerful life in every way. As Tony Robbins used to say, and I'm about to go off to his event, he would say, live with passion, right? This will help us be more effective in our life. Our guest today will be Jennifer Conwheeler, and she'll be talking about the genius of opposites, how introverts and extroverts achieve extraordinary results together. You're going to hear some stuff today that might not be what you expect, so get ready for that. But before we dive into that, I just want to address a couple of things. Number one, Fernando put a great article into the chat for our Venture Alliance Mastermind group on Voxer. And it was, he says, the title of the article is a Wall Street Journal article, Driverless Cars to Fuel Suburban Sprawl, from the Wall Street Journal. And he says, Jason, I believe you can say, I told you so. Well, thanks for sending that over. I appreciate it. And yes, I think I'm going to be saying I told you so, because we may well be on the verge of seeing the rise of suburbia. You know, there's this word, it's called renascent, right? It's like, I'm sure it's taken from the word renaissance, and it means coming back into being, life, or vigor, renascent. So you say something is renascent at this time. Of course, that trend has gone on and off, and the pendulum is swinging back and forth throughout history of pretty much all things. But suburbia became really an American phenomenon after World War II, with our huge romance with the automobile and all of the wealth that was in America, because America really just massively won the Industrial Revolution in so many ways, because the rest of the world was destroyed after World War II, and America jumped in and through, what was it, the Marshall Plan, right? I hope I'm not getting that wrong. That would be really embarrassing. Yes, I think it was the Marshall Plan. but forgive me if I didn't get that right. Rebuilt a lot of the world, rebuilt a lot of Europe and Japan and so forth. We saw that all take place. And, you know, you could argue that America was just being really generous, or that that was just a good business plan, because all those other countries became our customer for a long time. And then, well, then what happened? You know what I'm going to say, right? The pendulum shifted back in the other direction. And our insanely successful automobile industry was probably following what Napoleon Bonaparte admonished us not to do, when he said, the most dangerous moment comes with victory, because that's when we become cocky and complacent and entitled. And that's what the American auto industry did in the 70s, right? They didn't notice the change, and Japan came in and just took over, and Detroit got a beating, as Detroit was getting fat and happy and over-unionized and had a bunch of crooked governors and, well, You don't have a governor for a city, Jason. Yes, that's a mayor. I understand that. But a lot of crooked government officials, and you saw that Model Cities program and giving the unions too much power, and these fat cat auto industry people, they got their comeuppance, right? And that really, they got in trouble. And Japan ate their lunch for a long time. And now, interestingly, you see things, I don't know, maybe they're switching back. I mean, it's hard not to argue that Tesla isn't going to take a huge bite out of Lexus and Mercedes and BMW. I mean, they had the biggest product launch in world history recently when they launched the Model 3 car. And I put a deposit on one of those just for kicks, if nothing else. I figure, hey, I could sell my position. I have a name for that, by the way. I call it carbitrage. Yeah, not arbitrage, carbitrage. It's not an investment strategy, folks, but, you know, it's just funny money to fool around with. So about 400,000 people put deposits on those cars. It's mind-boggling. That is insane. The biggest product launch in all world history right there with good old Elon Musk, the crony capitalist himself, but certainly a bright guy. So you know, I try to be honest in my assessment of these people. I'm not going to believe that Elon is a god like so many others. He's a super bright businessman and a good crony capitalist. Note that I do not endorse crony capitalism, just so you know, in case you're wondering. But yeah, so that's an American car company. I mean, just note that Tesla is an American car manufacturer, right? So we will see where that all goes. But yeah, suburbia is renascent at this time. I think suburbia is about to have a new resurgence. And guess what, folks? You listeners are lucky, because if you're following our investment plan, you've already got a bunch of suburban properties, don't you? Because most of our stuff is suburban. We don't invest in the urban core because it's either too blighted and it's just a crime-ridden crap hole, or it's too expensive. If it's become gentrified, it's just way too expensive. So it really just doesn't work for investors, or at least almost never would the city, the urban core type areas work. But the suburban areas, that's where thousands of properties purchased by our clients exist. So, hey, you know, if this prediction is true and my prediction is accurate, and I have a feeling I might be right about this one, I've been saying it for a while, we shall see. We shall see. Someone asked me recently about cap rates, and I've gone over this before, but I just wanted, before we get to our guests, I just want to mention this real quickly. I've got a great video on my YouTube channel and on the front page of the jasonhartman.com website. Right there on the homepage, there's a fantastic video you should watch. And if you've already seen it, you should watch it again. Yes, repetition is the mother of skill. You should see it again. So this video is about how to analyze an investment property and how to read a proforma. And cap rates are the thing, that is the metric by which commercial real estate people live and die. They use it all the time. It's like their first number that they look at. Why is it that we don't look at it as much in the residential investment side of the business? Well, I'm not going to go into a long explanation on this, but just quickly, let me tell you. It's not as meaningful in the residential side of the world because, of course, it leaves some very important things out that are more applicable to the residential investment business than they are to the commercial investment business. And those things are leverage and appreciation. It leaves them out. It does not consider them. And those two things are more prevalent in this world, because the properties, the humble single-family home is the best appreciating asset class of all of them. Now, in commercial property, you have the opportunity sometimes to add more value, but that's not really the same thing as appreciation. So that's the first thing to note. They do not, generally speaking, appreciate as well as our humble single-family homes. Well, why is that? It's because the single-family homes can be sold to people who don't buy things that make sense, and that may be your buyer. Now, you hopefully are listening to the show, and you are listening to our advice, and listening to our investment counselors, and you are buying things that make sense the day you buy them, because you follow commandment number 5. What is commandment number 5, you ask? Thou shalt not gamble. Thou shalt not gamble. You must, the property must make sense the day you buy it, or you do not buy it. Absolutely. So cap rate doesn't really give us enough information. But then why would it be that all these sophisticated commercial real estate people love it so much? Well, I'll tell you. Because those deals are so much more complicated, and their income-expense ratios can differ so widely compared to a typical single-family investment home, that cap rate is a pretty good metric for them. And here's why. Say, for example, they're looking at an apartment complex, or they're looking at a self-storage facility, or an office building, or a mobile home park, or a retail property. All of these properties have different customs and rules around which people buy them and lease them and invest in them and manage them. And so their cost structures are dramatically different. For example, if you owned a little shopping center, a little strip mall, for example, that say had 3 or 5 little tenants, maybe a dry cleaner, a Subway sandwich shop, and a Starbucks or something like that, right? And a couple little tenants in there, you would lease those properties to tenants usually on triple net leases, where the tenant pays for everything and the costs all pass through to the tenant. Now, I know a lot of you listening might be saying, well, Jason, I sure like that deal. Yeah, of course you do. But what you don't know is that the cap rates generally suck on those deals. The returns are terrible. They're not nearly as good as what we can achieve in the residential investment business. A lot of doctors like those deals because, well, you know, no offense, doctors, you're great scientists, but generally speaking, no, doctors and dentists, they're notoriously poor business people. And this is just kind of the way it works, right? Some people have a good mind for money, and some people have a good mind for science, and never the two shall meet, or rarely shall they meet. Now, some doctors are very successful in investing, but most of them, you know, they'll just buy one of those little shopping centers, or they'll go in with 3 of their doctor buddies and buy one of those little centers. And when the tenants move in, all the tenant improvements, in other words, the build-out of the inside of the property, the TIs, the tenant improvements, will be paid for by the tenant. Now, contrast that to an office building. An office building is exactly the opposite. On an office building, those leases are what's called full service gross, most of the time, not always. Well, I don't even know if I should say most of the time, but look, on the office spaces I've leased over the years, they've all been the full service gross type of lease. And so the cost structure, dramatically different. The tenant improvements, the TIs, when I want to build out the inside of the office space I leased, well, the landlord is usually responsible for that. And they will provide an allowance as you're negotiating the lease. So they might say, well, we will give you an allowance of maybe $30 or $35 per square foot to build out the office space and make it the way I want it for my office, my business. And that's completely different than retail properties. So this is why cap rate is important in the commercial real estate business. It makes it much easier to compare. Should I put my money into an office property or a retail property or a self-storage or a mobile home park or an apartment complex? Because they all have dramatically different customs around which they operate. In the residential world, cap rate is a kind of a lousy metric. It's just not that good. It leaves out some very important factors like leverage and appreciation. It's just not that great. There are better metrics. And if you want to find out what those metrics are in the residential investment side, just go to jasonhartman.com and watch that little free video on the front page, on the homepage of the website. It's 27 minutes long. It'll make you a fantastic investor. If there's any one piece of content that will give you a great overview and that you should review as an investor every 6 months or so, it's that. Actually, I'll tell you this. You could even skip an episode of my podcast because those are the fundamentals. And I really want to make sure you stay in touch with the fundamentals of investing. And that's what's on that video. So make sure you check that out and that'll be a good thing. Hey, I want to play a little quick video for you. And this is, it's just a minute and a half. And pardon my lousy sound quality. It's actually not that bad, but I'm just playing this video on my little iPod Touch here for you. I know this is very homegrown here. We could do this right and could do it a lot better, of course, but it's good enough, you know, and it's just a little minute and a half video. And you know how I'm always saying it's an amazing time to be alive? Well, that is so, so true, of course. It is an amazing time to be alive as we are at the inflection point, I believe, of so many radical improvements in technology. And this video is about the singularity. And so just check this out before we get to our guest today and we talk about the genius of opposites.
Kevin Kelly describes the emergence of language as a singularity. He says if you draw a line in the sand, the human's pre-language and the human's post-language, the world post-language would be unimaginable to the humans on the other side of that line. And so perhaps we are due for another kind of consciousness reset. So we have artificial intelligence advancing exponentially, biotechnology, mastering the information processes of biology, nanotechnology, you know, patterning atoms, the building blocks of the material world. Three overlapping revolutions set to remake the world as we know it.
I think that the next 10 to 20 years will be comparable to the next century or two, as seen from the past.
I think ultimately we are changing society. We are co-evolving with technology.
Rick Kurzweil is the chief engineer at Google now. He wants to create a machine that makes 300 trillion calculations per second and to share that with a billion people. So that's a brain attached to the internet.
This sounds like science fiction, but this is all coming so quickly. Are we a combination of a man and a machine? Or are we literally going in and changing the genetic structure, the future of our species?
And you never realize that the singularity is happening until you're on the other side. And then you're like, wow, it's a different world. The thing is, usually those things are generational. The thing is, now it's happening within one's lifespan. So it's kind of, we get to bear witness to it.
Well, folks, it is an amazing time to be alive. It's a totally amazing time to be alive. And I hope you wake up every day grateful and appreciative and excited as we all anticipate all this incredible stuff that is happening. Yes, there are forces, there are very dark forces out there. Big government, socialism, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all very dark forces here, right? Do you notice how I just threw big government in with ISIS? I'm going to leave that one alone because I'm not sure I disagree in terms of the destruction they can do, but anyway, whatever. Some of this, folks, I do say purely for entertainment value. That's my disclaimer. In either case, go to hartmaneducation.com and check out the great courses we have there. Many of you have purchased those. We thank you for that. And really check those out. There's some really good content there for you at hartmaneducation.com, our new little education portal. And then, of course, at jasonhartman.com for properties and blog resources, articles, past episodes of podcasts. Make sure you're subscribing to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. And be sure to check out our other podcasts as well by just going to whatever podcast platform you use, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, whatever, and just type my name, Jason Hartman, and you will see all kinds of great content out there on a variety of topics that are so important to all of our lives. In either case, this is a 10th episode show, so let's go to our guest, Jennifer, and let's talk about the genius of opposites. It's my pleasure to welcome Jennifer Konweiler to the show. She is the author of three great books, The Introverted Leader, Building on Your Quiet Strength, and Quiet Influence, The Introvert's Guide to Making a Difference, and author of her newest book, The Genius of Opposites, How Introverts and Extroverts Achieve Extraordinary Results Together. Jennifer, welcome. How are you?
Oh, Jason, I'm great. Thank you so much.
Good. Now, I hope you're not too shy to do this interview with me.
Actually, you'll be surprised to know that I'm actually, don't test out as an introvert, but I call myself a champion of introverts because I've learned to appreciate introverts in my life and in work. So, no, I'm definitely not a shy, retiring type, Jason.
Well, you know, that actually kind of brings up an interesting point, and maybe you can start by addressing this one. Is shyness the same thing as introversion, or though I doubt those are the same.
Actually, no, you're absolutely right. Your doubt is correct there. Shyness has to do more with social and psychological anxiety. It can be really debilitating for people. But you know, introversion is, and thankfully we're learning more and people are learning more about what this means. It's really how you're wired, Jason. It's just the way you are. There's no problem associated with being introverted.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would agree. I would think so. I would hope so, at least. Yeah, good. So let's talk first about your first two books, if we can, and kind of make the and bring it all together with the idea of, you know, the genius of opposites and how these two types work together. Can you really sort of divide the world into two types only? Of course, there are more than two, but I mean, do we all sort of fall into either introvert or extrovert, or is there another category we're not thinking of?
Well, we're learning a lot about introverts and extroverts, and certainly, as you probably know, and many of our listeners, it's been in the press a lot. It's kind of a hot topic, you know, but it really goes back to the days of Carl Jung, the psychologist who came after Freud or was in that period of time. And, you know, he really said that there was a personality type that was introverted. And it's really, Jason, about energy, where you get your energy from. Introverts get their energies in their head, extroverts from outside themselves, from other people, and get stimulated that way. So is there an introvert and an extrovert temperament? I would say yes. I subscribe to the feeling, to the belief that we are typically one way or another. However, it's really like a spectrum. You know, so you think about it, most introverts and extroverts are sort of in the middle, if you think about it as a bell curve. Most of them fall, very few of us are very extreme introverts or extroverts. So, you know, there might be situations that we're very comfortable in, let's say when we're out with friends, being very extroverted, but yet when we're in a meeting with a tough client, we may shut down and really go into ourselves and be more of an introverted type person. So I always talk about what behaviors work for you and what don't.
Yeah, and I would say that probably everybody you would ask would consider me an extrovert, right?
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Boy, you know, a really cute girl walks by and I try to talk to her and I suddenly become kind of introverted. It's a terrible thing.
Well, you're kind of cute too, but I think you shut down, right?
Oh, I don't know. It's just we get all self-conscious or something, you know?
Well, certainly. But one of the things that that is a good indicator as to whether or not you might be on, you know, one side or the other, Jason, has a lot to do with your recharge. You know, it's like a battery. Like batteries are recharged, and how much time do you need to recharge that battery by being by yourself, you know, being by yourself? And if you say to me, and if I ask you that question, you know, how important is that to you? And you say, I must have that, you know, after a day of being out and about and being with people and talking all day, if I don't have that time to be by myself and take quiet time, I'm really going to get stressed out. Whereas an extrovert will say to you, yeah, that's important, I need that, but I can't have too much of that or I'm going to go crazy. So I don't really need it. It's not a must-have. So oftentimes I think that's the real differentiator that I've found in all of my work and my research.
Yeah, okay. Sometimes I feel like that too. You know, I kind of spend my whole day talking to people and in interacting and so forth, and I just really like being alone and not talking to anybody. How do you test yourself? How do you know what you are?
Well, there's actually tests that you can take. You know, a number of our listeners have probably been exposed to tests like the Myers-Briggs, which is the one that I
love Myers-Briggs. I mean, I'm an ENTJ, by the way.
Oh, are you? Okay. So you, and but we may not, you may not be a strong E, you know, an extrovert, a real strong extrovert. And there's lots of available quizzes right now online. If you just Google, you know, personality assessment or introvert assessment, you can find that. I also have one on my website that you can take, which really focuses more, which is in my area of expertise, which is more on leadership and the workplace. So you can find out how much you know about what an introverted leader is, what a quiet influencer is. And we rotate the quizzes on there. So feel free to go to JenniferConweller.com and see how high your knowledge level is.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, tell us about the introverted type, because, you know, I think it's kind of like they don't get equal time, do they, in our society? Is it a valid statement to say the extroverts get all the attention?
It is the extrovert ideal, isn't it? Most of our workplaces and our organizations are type A, you know, the person who speaks quickly or gets their word in there in the meeting is the one that everybody listens to. But in fact, the person who's introverted and is thoughtful, who may not speak up as quickly, oftentimes has more well thought out ideas, Jason. So yeah, there's a lot of a prejudice against and bias, I think, that still exists against introverts, you know, particularly in the pressure to be on teams, to be together and making quick decisions. Those things can be a problem. You know, we live it, particularly in the United States. You know, it's such a fast talking kind of world, and a lot of your folks who are investing in real estate know that, you know, there's a quick pace to things, and introverts take their time. They prepare. A couple of their qualities, you know, they're calm, they're thoughtful, they prepare, they listen. They're incredible listeners. But that's not necessarily always valued by the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have to think that if you look at sort of a type, you know, an engineer, for example, engineers are super valuable, and engineers are just incredibly valuable people in society, because they actually build things, you know, and there's this, I gotta find that commercial. I don't know if you ever saw this, Jennifer, or if any of our audience members did, but there's a sort of a funny commercial that really play, and it's really quite accurate. I saw it a few years back, and it was this Indian guy, and he is the inventor of the USB plug, right? I mean, what, talk about something that revolutionized the world, right? Nobody right. thinks of it too often, but we use those every day pretty much, right? The USB. And it shows, you know, a bunch of sexy girls pulling his shirt off like he's a rock star, right? And then the rock star getting no attention. You know, it's true.
I wonder what they were promoting in that commercial.
I don't remember even what the commercial's about, but
I think a lot of introverts would be pleased to know.
Yeah, but you know, if you think of that mindset, like the engineer type mind, is a thoughtful, internal focused brain, probably, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's why I started writing these books and started doing more work in this area, Jason, because I was working in so many places where those brilliant people who we know have invented a lot of the things that we use and we take for granted and have made such incredible contributions. A lot of those more technical people, the folks that, or financial people, or folks that really work a lot with data and information, they were oftentimes being overlooked and ignored and really misunderstood. And when you think about it, their work place and their organizations, their managers, their teammates were really missing out on, I would guesstimate to say about 50% of the population really is introverted. So you think about how that translates into, you know, lost revenue, lost productivity, lost creativity. So I was really on a mission to start exposing the whole idea of how important it is to pay attention to introverts and to value their strengths, and that they don't need to become extroverts. That's the real key theme that I discovered, Jason, in really talking with so many introverted leaders, you know, people like Doug Conan, who's a former head of Campbell Soup Company.
I had Doug on the show.
Oh, yeah, did you? You know Doug. Yeah. You know, he's a wonderful interview, and you know Doug is calm and he's measured in his approach. And, you know, you think about how one of the techniques that he used as an example of a wonderful introverted leader, he may have mentioned this on the program, where he wrote he writes individual notes to people,
right,
recognizing
mm-hmm.
them. Right? And he's known for that, that type of a practice. That's not something an extrovert necessarily would take the time to do. So introverts are so powerful, but I wanted to get the message out that they need to do it in their own way and not become extroverts in order to be successful.
Yeah, I think a lot of them have kind of tried to become extroverts. Maybe they heard or been told, hey, if you want to get ahead in your career, you got to be more outgoing, right? Or something like that. And so how can they build upon their strength? And then let's put it together and talk about how the two can work together more effectively.
Sure. Well, I think I identified a number of strengths. I mentioned a couple of them already, like preparation and listening and taking quiet time and writing, another strategy that introverts use very effectively, and having focused conversations, one-on-one conversations. So taking those and really leveraging those strengths. So for instance, you're trying to get an idea approved by a group you're working with. And, instead of, shouting it from the rooftops, the effective introverts I know have quiet conversations with the people who are the decision makers, we might call them the stakeholders, who have some impact. And they use that strength to really hash out the issues, to work through conflicts, to give each other feedback. And that would be an example of how they use a strength to really get their goals met. So once they become aware and own the strengths that they have, there's no stopping introverts in being successful. That also said, all of us, introverts and extroverts, need to flex. So there are times when you talk about making a speech and being out there. There's many introverted leaders, people. I think about an author, Adam Grant, that I know, who wrote Give and Take, and he talked about what he does to get ready for a speech. He uses his skill of preparation, but he also practices all the time and gets himself over that hump. So you still have to be out there and engaged and networking and doing the more extrovert kinds of things, but you can, again, use your strengths in preparation to really be excellent in those things. In fact, the people who network, I know, who are introverts, they take the time to consider, who is it I want to meet at this get-together, what's my purpose? They use that thoughtfulness that I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good points. Okay. What else do you want us to know about this, the quiet genius? On the first two books, what's the difference between those two?
Well, that's a good question. The first book was called The Introverted Leader, and that came out in 2009. And that was really focused on people who are emerging leaders, want to really ramp up their management and leadership skills. So there's a lot of management stuff in there. Or I shouldn't say stuff. I should be more erudite than that. It's real content. There's a model to
It's all
you.
Just stuff in the end.
It's all just stuff rather than all that leadership gibberish, right? So it's really, taking a model that I developed called the 4 P's, which helps leaders and managers ramp up their skills. So they learn how to have a conversation with employees and how to network, and applies that model to all of them. And it's very user-friendly. It's very practical, particularly for people who want to step more into leadership roles or increase their impactfulness if they're already in a leadership role. And then the second book, Quiet Influence, really emerged from a lot of people who said, well, I don't really need so much help in leading. I need to make a difference with people across my organization, with my clients, with my vendors. I have people I don't have authority over, Jason, but I still need to influence. So I created the Quiet Influence process to help them, again, step into their own power, their own introverted power in doing it. It's gotten a lot of really good response. Both books I'm very pleased to see have hit a nerve. And I guess I listen to the people who are my readers.
Can you tell us some more, give us any more tips about stepping into the introvert stepping into their greatness? What else can they do?
What else can they do? Well, specifically, they can listen. Listening is their sweet spot. And so when they listen, to really use the skill of paraphrasing and to use that as a tool for them to buy time. This can be very helpful for an introvert who isn't necessarily as quick in responding to a question or to, in a social reception kind of networking gig. They can use that paraphrasing skill to say back to that person in their own words what they're hearing, and it gets the other person to talk more and to expound. And so that's an example of something that they can do where they can take a tool that they're excellent at and use it to really give themselves the time that they need. that would be one example, I think, of that I could share. Another one is social media. You know, a lot of people look at social media as it's like fire. It can burn your house down or it could really warm you. And so what social media is really not a, it's not an option anymore. We all have to somehow be engaged. But what I found with successful quiet influencers is that they're very thoughtful in how they approach it. So for instance, they decide, well, what's my goal here? Is it to, you know, connect with other people in my industry? So they decide, well, here's the platform I'm going to use. I'm going to get involved in LinkedIn, or I'm going to do Facebook, and I'm going to get involved in a group, and I'm going to contribute, and I'm going to follow, you know, leaders like Jason and engage with him online. So they have a reason why they're on there. So they're not like the extroverts a lot of times, you know, are checking, and they're kind of random, and there's no real strategy. But I think, again, using the purposeful approach to looking at social media as how it can build your business is really something that introverts can do beautifully.
Would it be fair to say that introverts are less reckless and extroverts are more reckless?
I guess you could put it that way. When you say
would recklessness be a, would that be a...
Would you say risk-taking? How are you looking at recklessness?
Well, I don't know. You know, you're talking about like the preparation, the thoughtfulness, the mindfulness that introverts go through. And it just kind of made me want to make that comparison. I'm not sure it's
fair. Well, no, that's
fair,
okay.
I guess I may be one of the more reckless ones probably then.
Yeah, but I think what the extroverts learn from the introverts who aren't perhaps, you know, when you say reckless, it's all about risk, right? And I know many introverts. In fact, most of the successful introverted leaders I know do take risks. But they don't do it in the same way maybe that extroverts do. They do it in a way that's more thoughtful. They're still pushing themselves. I found them doing that a lot, like stepping out of their comfort zone and stretching themselves, but maybe not doing it half-cocked like some of the extroverts do, right? And they admire extroverts. Most introverts will tell you some of my best friends are extroverts. I love their energy, and they push me to try new things.
Okay, yeah, good stuff. So how does this break down or differ, if it does at all, Jennifer, between the genders?
Well, the statistics are very fuzzy on all of this, Jason, to be honest. I mean, you can look at different research studies, and I don't know that there are any more women than there are men in terms of introverts, extroverts, because the studies are really based on people that have taken the Myers-Briggs, and they're really a very small proportion of those. But I will tell you, I've studied women who are introverted for several years now, and I'm really drawn to this area being a woman myself, but also hearing from a lot of my readers and people who I speak in audiences to who talk about the discrimination. I don't want to use, that's a strong word, but the frustration they feel in being women in male-dominated organizations, because you think about it, it is hard to be heard sometimes for women who are trying to carve their path and connect with other men. And so if they are introverted, there's the pressure to be, you know, sort of happy and out there and engaged, you know, the pressure that a lot of women feel to be sort of the nice, smiling, happy person. Well, introverts who are in their head don't necessarily show that, male or female, but women feel some pressure to sort of be more social than they are. I think after a while, their confidence suffers from that. So it can be a challenge for women. So it's a matter of a lot of times just really connecting with other women in their industry, in their companies, and really getting the support that they need. I was just at an international engineering conference for women leaders, and it was so encouraging to see them really bond together and share ideas and hear from more senior women who have paved the way, to get some mentoring from them about how they did it. And you could just see the women's confidence just rise in that kind of atmosphere. So I think that women who are introverted, you know, certainly can deal with it and work with it, but they do have some special challenges, I would say.
Interesting. Just on balance, though, women have a lot of advantages, too. So, you know, it's...
You want to share what you think those are?
I was amazed when I recently, just a couple of months ago, I finished the book, The Myth of Male Power by Dr. Warren Farrell, who was a big speaker for the feminist movement when it began in the late 60s, early 70s. And he has really outlined some things pretty well. I can't remember all of them, but it's amazing. I mean, you know, each gender has their advantages and drawbacks. But I wanted to ask you about putting things together? How can these two work together?
Oh, okay. So the opposites, I talk about the genius of opposites.
That's your latest book.
Right. And really what I heard from my readers, what they were saying, you know, so we know we're an introvert, we know we're an extrovert. I'm attracted to them. I think they're great. They bring so many qualities, but they drive me crazy. And especially the things that we're attracted to, you know, opposites do attract. Everybody knows that, but they can also really go off the rails quickly. And what I found was the thing that kept these partnerships or keep these opposites from imploding, from staying on the course, is they focus, Jason, on results. They focus on outcomes. So, you know, in history, we've had so many successful opposites, you know, even going back to like, think about the Wright brothers, you know, they were known to fight all the time. They were totally opposite in temperament. You know, Lennon and McCarthy, Van Gogh and Theo, his brother, Taft and Roosevelt, Siskel and Ebert. I realize I'm mentioning all men here, you know, the film critics. They kept their eye on the ball. It's very interesting to read about them and to see videos of them and, you know, off camera, just ready to kill each other. But they both respected each other's talents. And that was key too. So, you know, really working at these relationships so that they could thrive. So there's a lot of exciting things that are coming out as we learn more and more. You know, and in today's world, Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg are very close, and they're very opposite. Mark Zuckerberg being more the introvert at Facebook, and Sheryl Sandberg being more the extrovert. And, you know, she helps coach him and he helps her on strategy. And, you know, they make a wonderful pair in terms of leading Facebook into real success. So, you know, it's very exciting to look at all that.
Yeah, I guess maybe that has to come from two perspectives when I ask that question. One perspective is, of course, each of the parties, the introvert and extrovert, knowing how to work with their opposite. But the other part of it would be, say that you are in a position of leadership, whatever you are, introvert or extrovert, but you've got these people under you who are different, who you need to help facilitate their relationship. So, you know, maybe that's another angle you want to share. Any thoughts on that side of it?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think that, you know, I came up with these five themes of the successful partnerships, but leaders and managers can certainly play a role in encouraging the dialogue between the two. You know, a lot of it is about, you know, taking the elephant out of the room, so to speak, Jason, right? And talking about when there are differences. I have one of the themes that I came up with is that was shared to me by a lot of the people I interviewed was it's called bring on the battles. Because oftentimes when partnerships are not sharing what's really going on with them, where their frustrations are, you know, where they're out of sync, that's when you start to have some real problems. And leaders and managers can encourage that. I'm not saying have an all-out war, but, you know, to help them manage crises together, to really, sometimes you have to even bring in a third party, you know, to break through an impasse. But if a leader, a manager is aware of these personality differences, they can be on the lookout for when implosions are going to occur. There was one manager who actually put two opposites together because he knew that they would learn from each other. And he sat back and he said, I knew there were going to be some fireworks. And there were. But, you know, I was able to coach them through it. And now I interviewed the two of them and they are just like best buddies now. So sometimes it takes that kind of friction to really get to the other side. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Give out your website again.
It's Jennifer Kahnweiler, JennifrKahnweiler.com. And everybody can, we're launching a brand new one in a few days, but everybody can go on there and, you know, sign up for our newsletter, take our quizzes, lots of free articles. And I'm also on Twitter at Jen Kahnweiler, J-E-N-N. And you guys will probably have that all on your site, J-E-N-N Kahnweiler. So I would love to stay in touch with your community and so appreciate the work you've been doing, Jason.
Any closing thoughts on this? Just to, you know, anything we didn't cover, maybe a question I didn't ask you?
I think you pretty much covered it. I just would like to say that we all should appreciate each other's differences. And I think accepting the alien is sometimes the best way we can go.
Yeah, excellent advice. Jennifer Kahnweiler, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've never really thought of Jason as subversive, but I just found out that's what Wall Street considers him to be.
Really? Now, how is that possible at all?
Simple. Wall Street believes that real estate investors are dangerous to their schemes because the dirty truth about income property is that it actually works in real life.
I know. I mean, how many people do you know, not including insiders, who created wealth with stocks, bonds, and mutual funds? Those options are for people who only want to pretend they're getting ahead.
Stocks and other non-direct traded assets are a losing game for most people. The typical scenario is you make a little, you lose a little, and spin your wheels for decades.
That's because the corporate crooks running the stock and bond investing game will always see to it that they win. This means, unless you're one of them, you will not win.
And unluckily for Wall Street, Jason has a unique ability to make the everyday person understand investing the way it should be. He shows them a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Yep, and that's why Jason offers a one-book set on creating wealth that comes with 20 digital download audios. He shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches you how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And this set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered for only $197.
To get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia Book 1, complete with over 20 hours of audio, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.